He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
Telling it like it is, giving you both sides of the story. This is Katz at Night.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now, here's John Katzimatidis.
This is Katz at Night, John Katzimatidis, and this is the 5 o'clock show, the number one show in the whole New York and the whole East Coast. And what's going on in the Ukraine? What's going on in Russia? Well, we have an exclusive. With us today is Nigel Farouk and out of the UK to get the perspective. What does Nigel feel is going on from the European perspective? Nigel, welcome to the show.
John, thank you very much. And the answer to your question is, what is happening is very, very frightening. Very, very frightening indeed. I'd always thought Vladimir Putin was a rational, logical player. And I can quite understand why those two eastern provinces, Donetsk and Luhansk, I can quite understand why he might want to think of them as Russian, because they're Russian speakers. And if they had a referendum, I've no doubt they would overwhelmingly vote, like Crimea, to be part of Russia. However, Western Ukraine is completely different. It does not want to be under Russian control. And yet, you know, he is subjecting them to a brutal war, and most worrying war we've seen in Europe since 1945. And the scary thing, John, is this. I'm not sure he's being rational anymore. He seems to want to rebuild a dream of Tsarist Russia, you know, going back to Catherine the Great and the big Russian Empire. And that would mean he would seriously think about going into Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Now, that poses a massive question for NATO, a massive question for America, because let's be frank, you know, without America, NATO is the British and not much else.
So, you're right. It's, you know, the Americans, the British, and the Canadians,
yeah.
The Germans are not going to be on our side. They're depending on all their energy from Putin.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's the most extraordinary situation that Germany's put itself in.
Turkey has never been on our side lately.
No, it's troubling. This is troubling. And I fear that if Putin does see weakness, genuine weakness, if NATO doesn't stand up for what it believed in since the late 1940s, that will send an even more dangerous signal to President Xi. And Taiwan is under threat. Let me tell you something. If the Chinese go in and take Taiwan, that is where the semiconductor chips come from. There's American technological firms working on it. They're not there yet. If the Chinese took Taiwan and stopped shipping us semiconductors, they would bring American industry, the car industry, for example, to a total grinding halt. So, you know, we are in dangerous.
Can we ask really China for the permission to wait 5 years before they jump in?
Mm-hmm. Well, we could do. I mean, none of this would be happening if Trump was in the White House. None of this. But it is. It is. And so, you know, Biden, why is Biden in America? Why is Biden not right now in Europe meeting other NATO leaders? What the hell is he doing?
Nigel Farage, are you surprised that the sanctions aren't working? One minute you heard Kamala Harris.
There are no real sanctions.
Oh, I know.
They're Mickey Mouse sanctions. Nothing really serious. The United States is still wire transferring money every day to Russia for the crude oil that's going into Boston.
So we're funding the war.
Yep, that's right. And here's the problem. Here's the trap.
And Germany insisted for Germany to say, oh, yes, we're on NATO's side. Germany insisted that we don't take them off the currency.
SWIFT
system.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, here's the truth of it. If we put tough sanctions on Russia and they stop sending gas to Germany, Germany would close down. So, we've got ourselves in a bit of a trap, or Germany particularly has got itself in a bit of a trap. And the other thing that worries me about this, about the whole incident, is it does seem to be pushing Russia and China closer together, and that's also very, very worrying. So the moment is now. You know, America is going to stay as the leader of the free world, as it's been unquestionably since 1945, or it's going to surrender it. And if it does, well, I'm afraid tens of millions of people in Eastern Europe are heading for a very, very dark future.
Nigel Farage, what do you think about Putin's mental state? His speech was very long. He was talking about Iraq and how the United States called us basically con artists. And then he also alluded to nuclear weapons. What do you think about what's going on in Putin's head right now?
I'd always seen him as a very calm, rational player. I'd always thought of him as being quite intelligent. I've watched him outfox Western leaders often over the course of the last 20 years. I am now very, very worried that this guy is not on the level anymore. So, yeah, I'm deeply concerned.
Well, Nigel, I am concerned, but he is still one smart guy. I'm more concerned about us on this
side. I think Putin is an evil person.
Congressman King?
Yeah, listen, Pete King, former congressman. As far as Putin, we cannot underestimate him. I mean, he may be smart, he may be brilliant, but if he's psychotic and if he has these delusions, this could really end the role that America's had in the world because of his energy supplies. And I just can't see if he's allowed to take any part, any significant part of the Ukraine. I can't see NATO countries coming to the defense of, let's say, the Polish border or Latvia or Estonia. I think incrementally he's willing to wait us out, knowing that he has that energy control.
Well, this needs to be a matter of a very big open public debate in the USA. The USA, the whole of the Western world, is at a crossroads here. And it's tough to say this in a way, because already America has paid the most massive price. World War I, World War II, without America, I would not have grown up a free person. There's no question about that. And so it is difficult to say to Americans again, we need your help. But I'm sorry, that's the truth of it.
Nigel, thank you so much for calling in today and WABC. We're trying to get the truth out. And thank you so much. And the truth is, we're in deep doo-doo, I think. Thank you. I want to welcome everybody here today. We didn't get a fast start because it's getting late in the UK. We have two common sense Democrats today. We have Judge Richard Weinberg. We have Governor David Patterson. And a common sense Republican. We have former Congressman Peter King.
Can I let the record show that I'm on the left of David Patterson tonight?
You're yes. Sitting on the left. You're definitely sitting on the left. And my sidekick, Lydia Serrani.
Yes.
And tell us about the TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. Tell us about the show today.
The show today, we've got a great show. We just spoke with Nigel Farage, and you can hear more of that, the entire interview, if you miss it, on WABCRadio.com. Next, we'll be speaking with Jonathan Wachtel. He is an acclaimed journalist. He served as director of communications and spokesperson for the U.S. mission to the United Nations, spent many, many years in Moscow. He's an expert there. Then, of course, Larry Kudlow, because it's TGIF Friday, Professor Alan Dershowitz, and Dr. Peter Michalos. There's definitely some big news on the COVID front that you don't want to miss.
And we're having a Russian call in today.
Kato Hechenov, and
he's going to give us the pulse of what's going on in Moscow.
Correct. He is the head of the Russian Heritage Foundation. But first, we have our first guest on the line, Jonathan Wachtel, and you helped set up the Moscow Bureau, correct? And you're a journalist, and you know everything that's going on in Ukraine. Tell us, what is the latest?
Hi there. Sorry, someone was knocking on my front door. thankfully, it's not the Russian forces.
Not yet.
It's the KGB.
Not yet.
Yeah, exactly. What's happening is Vladimir Putin is trying to figure out which of his aspirations he's going to be able to achieve in the most expedient way. So he's invaded Ukraine, felt that it was the right thing to do from his perspective, because the outcome can lead to a number of, there can be a number of outcomes to making a move like this that fit with his long-term goals. Among them, try to reestablish the former Soviet Union as much as he possibly can get away with. And he's going to try to navigate that, to try to figure out how far he can take things, if that means that he will completely occupy Ukraine and hold on to it and try to annex it en masse, or whether he'll establish a relationship within the Ukraine in which he'll get rid of President Zelensky, who is a Ukrainian patriot, get rid of him, put in another person like Yanukovych, who was the pro-Kremlin leader of the Ukraine, who was ousted in a national movement by Ukrainians, try to get a puppet regime back into Kiev, and then pull the forces out once you've established that type of relationship, which would be kind of similar to what we see with the relationship with Belarus, with the dictator Lukashenko in power there. Or he may decide to withdraw a bit because the economic pressures that are going to come to bear and some of the other considerations, including perhaps a popular uprising within Russia itself, because a lot of Russians are decent people and very upset about what's happening. And if they have the ability, they would be protesting in larger numbers than what we saw that got crushed the other day. He may feel that the most expedient thing is to try to get some concessions from the West, from the Ukrainian leadership itself, to allow him not to have this unfortunate thing from his perspective to be judged for having seized Crimea and for having seized the Donbass and Luhansk regions of eastern Ukraine, to sort of stop there and maybe get a nod that there won't be NATO expansion into Ukraine. There are a variety of outcomes, all of which are wins for Putin.
And, you know, nobody really thought that Putin was going to go in, but he's been saying that all he wants is guarantees that NATO is not going to put missiles in there, and I don't blame him for not asking that, and that the fact that it's not going to become a NATO country. And what do you think about that?
It's understandable if you have aspirations to reconstitute the Soviet Union. The last thing you want is to have a nuisance like NATO standing in your way. And not just standing in your way, having done things that kind of spoil your aspiration. Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia are NATO members. Those are former Soviet republics in the Baltics region of Europe. And Putin can't put his hands on those, because if he does, the NATO motto is one nation that gets attacked, it's as if you're attacking the entire alliance. So he knows he can't do anything about that. And yeah, he's upset that he doesn't have that ability. And he's upset that there's talk of the Ukraine going in that direction, and that the Ukrainians have been trying for well over a decade, actually since their independence in 91, there is talk of.
So this is a big, giant chess game. China has given Putin permission to do whatever negotiating he wants to do. It sounds like Putin is the junior partner of China?
Right. And then I'm sure Putin was watching, the world was watching and laughing at us of what happens in Afghanistan, and they are seeing Biden. He doesn't seem to be all there. And I think Putin was just like, it's either now or never if I'm going to fulfill my legacy and take over.
And then the other thing I've been told, if we put in defensive weapons for the Ukraine and Putin takes it over, well, just like China has Afghanistan's defensive weapons and offensive weapons, Russia will have defensive and offensive weapons of the United States back to Moscow. We could ship it directly to Moscow and avoid the—
Yeah, but I think we should give them the weapons to defend themselves. That, to me, was the biggest criticism of the Biden administration, the Obama administration.
Yeah, but here's the problem, yeah, Peter.
Unlike the Afghans,
I agree
the Ukrainians are going to fight.
I agree with you 110%. But we're not prepared to back them up.
Well, here, guys, here's the situation. And you know what? Let's call a spade a spade. All of our presidents, and I'm talking American presidents, for the last several, did not stand up to Putin the way that it needed to happen. Even under President Trump, we saw that there was still fighting going on in eastern Ukraine. There was still a Ukrainian army soldiers dying in battle. There is still shelling of civilian targets in that area. This has been going on, and there needed to be a containment done by any number of our presidents over the last 3 years to really hold the line. And this isn't just about Russia and reconstituting the Soviet Union. This is much bigger, because if Ukraine falls to the sway of Vladimir Putin, it means that an axis with China gets empowered by that. It's really back to the world domination game that we saw in the days of the worst of the Cold War. And we're not there now. I don't want to raise alarm bells, but this is really an important battle going on, both on the ground, but ideologically. And it doesn't show enough backbone. And the Europeans, our Western allies, don't show enough backbone right now. We're going to be in a hill of pain. It's just very serious. And even the talk of sanctions, and sanctions, we have no choice but to impose sanctions. We have to. In fact, there are chances that Putin wouldn't have had the courage, not that he's a fearful man, but he would have, he maybe wouldn't have taken the strategic move that he's done now had the Nord Stream thing been taken off the table. Had sanctions been imposed, he would have thought twice about it because he would have been facing pressures. The truth is, though, that he has an escape valve from any sanctions because of his wonderful relationship with China and Iran and Venezuela and Cuba and North Korea and a bunch of other
Germany
nations.
And Turkey.
Which is why we have to stand up to him. The longer he's allowed to do this.
The problem, Germany is in the same bed with them. They're getting almost 50% of their energy from
Russia. Right, which is why we have to reactivate the pipeline and we have to start drilling again. Otherwise, we might as well surrender now. I mean, if we're going
to
say.
And Turkey hasn't been loyal to us for a long time.
So then, since, no, Turkey is not. Yeah, Turkey is not. Germany, an interesting thing with Germany is Chancellor Schroeder, who was the Social Democrat chancellor of Germany, stepped down after he was left office and then became a Gazprom, you know, the Russian fossil fuel energy monstrosity that Vladimir Putin ended up using to enrich himself. He's been a member of Gazprom, and there's now talk within that party, within the Social Democratic Party of Germany, to strip Schroeder of his membership because they understand that what he did was treacherous, that he, in fact, is a traitor to the German people, if you really look at it that way.
Bottom line, they're lying. Yes, you're right.
And then I'm watching Hillary Clinton, of course, never let a good controversy go to waste. She's slamming Trump. How are they able to kind of configure all of this narrative and blame Trump? But thank you so much, Jonathan Wachtel, for your insight and your analysis. And we look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you, Jonathan.
You as well. Let's hope for the best.
Yes.
Thank you.
Now, I understand Governor Patterson. We had an interesting discussion yesterday. And you got a phone call last night. People yelling at you.
Well, I got a call from one of the major staff members to one of the conferences in Albany, and the assertion is that bail reform is being blamed for more than what problems bail reform might actually cause. So, for instance, the crime rate being up in all the major cities around the country right now, they all have stricter bail laws. So clearly, you know, that's probably true. But what I asked them to do is to
did they say you did wrong?
Speak the truth?
Well,
that's it.
I actually didn't even comment on the bail reform last night as much as I just said that if they didn't want to talk to Mayor Adams now, they probably will be dying to talk to him next year because it's an issue that affected the 2021 election. There's no reason it can't affect the 2022 election. That was actually an
New
analysis.
New Yorkers, like there was a Siena poll, 80% of New Yorkers, 90%, 85%.
Yeah.
They want to be safe. And it's not about being Democrats or Republicans. It's about people want to feel safe taking the subway or walking around the city. And we all endorse Mayor Adams in wanting that too.
And Governor Patterson, you said, show me the data that the bail reform isn't contributing to the higher crime rate. And what happens?
Well, I'm in the process of getting the data.
Going to get it, honey.
No. I'll get it by Monday. Believe me. Do you ever play roulette? Bet on black.
You. Yeah. I thought yesterday was Black History Day.
I don't bet on double zero. I never bet on double zero.
All right. Let's be clear.
Judge Weinberg?
Let's be clear. With all due respect to that staffer who spoke to you last night, Governor, there's a piece in the bail reform that specifically prohibits judges from people holding people in who are dangerous. We're the only state in the country that doesn't allow judges to have the discretion to hold people in now, who are dangerous.
Is it 3 strikes and you're out, or is it 14 strikes and you're
and
out?
And also, let's be...
How can you put criminals back on the street again?
And let's be clear, we're not saying it's all bail reform's fault. It's everything. It's a whole combination effect. So
they have created a climate of lawlessness.
Exactly. If you can shoplift, you can knife somebody, it's the DAs, it's the bail reform, it's everything. COVID also, it's the economy, it's everything. And the bail reform is not helping.
Okay. There's another bill that they could easily change. It wasn't part of bail reform.
And
that's the age to prosecute people.
Raise the age, right.
For adult prosecution rather than putting it in family court.
And Governor Patterson.
It used to be 16. Now it's 18. Put it back to 16.
Governor Patterson, you also said that. It's just a piece of it. It's not the whole thing that bail reform.
First of all, the judges not being able to look at a person's record. I mean, we have people right now.
And by the way,
the people are laughing at us. Has 24 indictments for criminal,
40, yeah,
dangerous criminal.
And judges are forced to let them out under this ridiculous law.
And that's the other part of the law where a woman gets raped or gets mugged.
Right.
And you're supposed to turn over
open file
the
discovery.
Home,
you
the
have
home
to give
address of the woman
exactly.
to
yes.
the guy
and
yes.
all the witnesses, and give the defendant the right with her attorney
to
visit the premises.
Tell those people that want those kind of laws to drop dead, because they're causing the death of so many people, and when they cause the death of so many people, they should be known as co-conspirators.
Can we notarize that? Can he write that?
Governor Patterson, go ahead. We got a minute left.
Drop dead, tell them.
Now, what was interesting, one thing that did come up that I didn't actually know, is that the Asian woman who was thrown on the tracks and
yes.
killed a few
Christina
weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
that was the third crime that this offender had committed.
Yeah.
The other was when he hit someone who was walking into the subway station.
Broke their nose.
He got out on bail. I did not know that bail was set by a judge. It wasn't set
by... So what is the difference?
What?
What's
no.
the difference?
In other words, that part of the problem is also the judges who are making the decisions.
Wait. Listen, now, I don't want to defend all judges, but number one, you have a large number of judges who are absolutely sick to death of this whole climate of lawlessness, and you have some judges standing up. The question is, when people vote for elected judges, number one, they have no idea who they're voting for. Number two, when you have appointing authorities like certain mayors who don't care about public safety and law and order, and they're not appointing the right judges, that's a problem too.
Guys, we got to take a break.
It would be.
When we come back, we're going to have Larry Kudlow to tell us what the heck is the economy doing.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. A common sense recap of the day's biggest stories. It's John Katzimatidis and Cats at Night on 77 WABC.
Well, we're back, and with us today is Larry Kudlow. And boy, did we have a roller coaster ride in the markets, and so many things going on, Russia, Ukraine. Larry Kudlow, you're one of the experts. The people across the country are depending on you. What do you think is going on?
Well, John, I think the rally in the stock market, which started after President Biden's announcement yesterday on sanctions, the rally really is because his sanctions were easy, not severe. And also, I would add, expectations about Fed policy are easy, not severe. So the economy is still going. And none of these issues are interrupting yet. They may. I don't approve at all of what Biden did. I think he made another major mistake helping Putin and hurting the Ukraine cause. But whatever I may think, the stock market breathed a sigh of relief that the sanctions weren't worse. Now, they may become worse, and I suspect they will become worse, but for the moment, what you got here was a relief rally.
And, well, it was up, what, 800 points? So something like that today, that's a big relief.
Yeah, and it actually, if you look at it, it was down 800 at one point yesterday. So it's really like a 1,600-point-plus move on the Dow. So it's a hell of a move. And well, you know, far be it for me to damage anybody's portfolio, but I'm just saying we still have a major inflation threat. The inflation numbers that came out today were just as bad as expected from the Fed's principal inflation target. And again, I think, you know, the Biden administration continues to mishandle the Ukraine story. I just want to make one point on the Ukraine story. What you have to do to stop Putin and his ambitions to, you know, damage America, destroy NATO, destroy the European Union, which is what he's really angling for. And he's not going to stop in the Ukraine. He's going to go elsewhere into Lithuania and the Baltics. But what has to be done here is two things. One of them is drill, drill, drill. Yep. In order to get the world oil price down, we have to step up our production of oil and natural gas and LNG exports, which we can do. But I will say this, the increase in oil prices in the last 6 to 9 months are benefiting. I mean, Putin made about $100 billion in profits to help finance his war. And point number two, we need to sanction Russia's central bank along with all of its commercial banks. Then you can't all payments have to flow through the central bank. And they will be deprived of any cash revenues. You know, oil, gas, commodities like wheat and other farm commodities, all that stuff is paid for in dollars.
But Germany vetoed that.
We don't. No, Germany didn't veto that.
They gave a condition that if they're going to go along with President Biden, that they cannot take Russia off the that system.
Larry, this is Pete King. If that's true, though, and I'm not John is wrong, doesn't that mean we're really abdicating to Russia and to Germany? I mean, Germany's going to have that kind of veto power going forward.
Let Larry talk.
Yeah.
Let me just finish the thought. I'm not talking about the SWIFT system, actually. The SWIFT system is a communication system. It's not a payment system. It's not as important as a lot of people think. I'm talking about the strategy that the Trump administration employed with Iran. We sanctioned Iran's central bank, and we sanctioned Iran's commercial banks, and we also hosted secondary sanctions so other commercial banks couldn't do business. That's what we need to do. Germany doesn't hold any veto power. This is something we can do unilaterally. These would be U.S. sanctions, and they would be dollar-based sanctions. And the important point here is, as I said, Russia's principal source of revenues are commodities, energy commodities and agriculture commodities. That's really all they do. So if we put sanctions, and now we've hit most of their commercial banks, but not all. If we complete it with sanctions on the central bank, that will stop their ability to sell goods, and that will stop their ability to reap any cash revenues, and that will hurt the war financing. So my point is a simple point. Stop financing Putin by shutting down our fossil fuel system and stop financing Putin by allowing his banking system to operate. You do that and you'll end his war goals. And that's what we need to do as soon as possible.
Larry Kudlow, I used the wrong word in veto. I apologize. It wasn't a veto. It was condition that they're going along. And the other thing is we're still paying the United States is still paying Putin, Russia, every day for the crude oil going into the Boston Harbor.
What do you?
Well, that's my first point is that we need to drill more. We need to produce more oil, more natural gas, and more LNG exports. Biden has the story completely wrong. Yesterday at his press conference, again, he attacked the fossil fuel companies. That is stupid. The fossil fuel companies, who are the best in the world and make the cleanest energy in the world, are our savior. They are our solution. And they will take away, not only will they relieve pressure at the gasoline pump for Americans by producing more. I mean, we can go into 14 to 15 million barrels per day in the next 18 months if Biden would let us. So far, Biden has put regulatory restrictions, pipelines, and new leasing on federal lands. It's crazy. So that's one source of cash going to Putin. We should stop that. The second source is we should stop transactions and payments. Now, I'm not talking about the SWIFT system, John. I'm saying direct sanctions on the Russian central bank along with their commercial banks, and you will do great damage to Putin's cash flow. And once you take away his financing, well, then you'll take away his war aid.
Are you worried about the threats Putin has made? What, Lydia, you remember, what did he actually said? If you do anything like that...
Right, you'll see consequences the world has never seen before. Larry Kudlow, also Jen
Let him answer the question.
Okay.
Well, look, Putin says a lot of things. Question is, can he finance his threats? And the answer is,
yeah,
he can if we let him. So far, we have let him. But he can't if we prevent him.
Maybe China's so backing him up.
China doesn't have China can't help him because none of these commodities, whether it's oil, gas, or agriculture, they're not priced in yuan. And the yuan is just a tiny fraction of the world's currency payment system. The dollar is like 90%. The yuan is like, I don't know, 1% to 2%. China has capital controls, so they can't help him on the financing. They can't help him on any of this. But if you sanction their central bank, then they can't make any payments and they can't accept any payments. That's why I emphasize the financing. Now, I will say this regarding Putin's threats. I mean, I know a lot of national security people that I've spoken to in the last 48 hours who believe that if after he gets done with Ukraine, he'll probably take over Kyiv in due course of the next 24, 48 hours. He'll wind up putting his own puppet guy in charge. Many people think his next target is going to be Lithuania. The Baltics are very, very vulnerable. And NATO needs to make a very clear statement that they will defend the Baltics, who are NATO members. So far, they have not made that statement, and the United States has not made that statement.
Well,
so,
the minute we make that statement, the market will be down 5,000 points.
The market may fall in the short run, but in the long run, low taxes, low regulations, and low inflation will bring the markets back. I'm not worried about the market. I mean, the markets are a function of long-run economic policy. Right now, economic policy is on the wrong track. Biden is spending and inflating and over-regulating, and he's doing damage to the economy. But the cavalry's coming. We're going to retake Congress come November, and we'll start to slowly straighten out the economic policies when we take the White House in 2024. What I am worried about is letting this crazy maniac, Vladimir Putin, letting him loose to destroy. It's just not about the Ukraine. Putin is trying to damage the United States. He's trying to break up the European Union. He's trying to break up NATO. These things have to be stopped. Nations' sovereignty has to be protected. There has to be a rule of law in international politics and activities. And we can't let Putin get away with this. Now, that's tricky business, but I'm just saying we're business people, economics people. Go after his finances. You stop his finances, you will either slow him down or you'll stop him.
Larry Kudlow, thank you so much for your wisdom. You have been more right than wrong, and I think you're right in a lot of respects. And God bless you, and have a great weekend.
Thank you, John. Thanks to everybody. Take care.
And
don't forget to say his show on when his show is.
His show, Larry Kudlow's on every Saturday morning from 10 to 1. And I look forward every Saturday morning to listening to Larry Kudlow on WABCRadio.com, on 77 WABC on your iPhone, and on 770 on your AM dial. And let's take a break. And when we come back,
We're going to have a report about Russia, how the Russians are feeling about everything, from Cato Hetchinoff. He's the head of the Russian Heritage Foundation.
John Katzenmatidis, 77 WABC.
Welcome back.
Welcome back, Cotter.
Yeah. While we try to get our next guest on the line, I have a question for you, John Katzmatidis. I asked you during the break. So Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, she was specifically asked, you know, Republicans and conservatives are saying we're seeing these high gas prices and they're blaming it on the fact that Biden's first executive order, he shuts down the XL pipeline. Is that true or false? She said it's absolutely false. The XL pipeline was only 8% complete. And this is all because of OPEC and price gouging. And we asked for increased production,
yes,
blah, blah, blah.
But also, why don't you ask? How many barrels a day were we delivering, Congressman? 13.5 million barrels a day?
Yeah.
And what are we down to now, 11.5?
Yeah, and the fact is
that, so why did we drop 2 million barrels?
Yeah, and also he stopped drilling in the Arctic. He stopped the explorations, and they're putting so many restrictions on the production of oil. It's the most, to me, the worst self-inflicted wound ever.
Well, and this all started Barack Obama, by the way. He's the first person to shut down the permit of the XL pipeline back in 2014.
It would have been finished already.
Exactly.
Introduce our new guest.
Okay, so we have on the line for us right now Cato Hetchinoff. He is the head of the Russian Heritage Foundation. He also lived in Moscow for 20 years. Cato, how are you?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone.
So tell us, how are the Russians feeling about everything going on?
Yeah, well, no doubt about it. I'm here down here in St. Petersburg, Florida, and living overseas for over 20 years. I'm still in touch with all my friends, especially expats from New York City and from New Jersey. And, you know, it all caught us by, you know, shock per se. Well, it was escalating. Something was building up. So my friends who were posting their posts when they woke up in the morning is like, everyone was definitely in shock. Like, did this actually happen? However, as it progresses right now, already the day after, there's various thoughts and concerns and one of my friends stated this this morning, is the war is going to be over today because Zelensky is already basically doo-doo in his pants. That's
so they think of Zelensky's going to give it up. He's going to surrender.
Oh, he is ready. He's pretty much right now. He does not know what to do.
And that's the talk around the Moscow among the folks.
There's everything. First of all, nobody wants war. Absolutely. Everyone's against any type of war. But everybody also knew, especially the people who have been there for some time, like myself. I'm talking about expats now, my friends who are expats who are living there. And we all knew that this is going to come a day or a time somehow that there's going to be some sort of serious conflict, because this conflict has been around already since, you know, I'll put down the year at 2014, the start of Euromaidan. And Euromaidan was a so-called Orange Revolution that was financed by us here in the United States. So are you with me?
I'm listening.
Yeah, so like I said, just about all my friends are posting like they're in shock, but we all knew this is going to come
Putin had 1,700 people arrested in the square yesterday or something. What happened?
Out in the streets, they were trying to demonstrate against the war, which is normal. It's 900. The first report, there was 900. I'm pretty sure there were more that came through later on.
Understood.
Now, these expats, are they supporting the U.S.? Are they supporting Russia? Are they standing with Ukraine? Are they sympathetic to Putin, who I think is a horrible dictator and a murderer?
Well, no. That's why you got to think out of the box a little bit. This is the way you think here, and it's all right to think that way. But, you know, when you come out there, who am I talking with? Is it Sydney?
This is Congressman Peter King.
Yeah, we have Dershowitz waiting on the other line.
Right,
we have to take it.
Okay. Well, thank okay. Well, thank you so you, much, Cato. Thank you for all your insight.
And thank you
thank
for
you.
Your input of your friends living in Moscow right now.
Yeah, everyone, like I said, everyone's a patriot. We're all true fighting blue Americans, okay? And if you want to, you know, I could always connect you all, speak to directly to them.
We'll talk over the weekend, Cato.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you. Let's go to
Professor Dershowitz. Just how many years, how many decades at Harvard Law again, Professor Dershowitz?
Too many. 50 years.
Half a century.
Yeah.
So, Alan.
Hey, we got another Harvard, and we got another Harvard person.
Well, that's what we want to talk to you about, Alan.
Yeah. There you
what
go.
Do you think? We have a new nominee for the Supreme Court of the United States. What do you think?
I think she's terrific. I don't like the process by which she was selected. I don't like the fact that the president campaigned to exclude everybody but black women. I think he picked the right person. She adds diversity to the court. Why does she add diversity to the court? Because she's a public defender. And there have been no public defenders on the court for many, many years. And, you know, President Biden is the first president ever to have been a public defender. So we're getting diversity now, public defenders. We don't have diversity in terms of law schools. I think we now have, I don't remember, is it five from Yale, four from Yale, three or four from Harvard, one from
Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Thank you, Congressman King.
Notre Dame's a great school.
She's young, though. She's only 51.
I know. And if she serves as long as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she'll be on the court for, 35 years or
Alan,
more.
I looked at her resume when she when this first started being talked about as one of the three finalists. She has an impeccable resume. Let me tell you what my concern is, and I don't know the judge at all. My concern is that she's now a predictable vote for a particular ideology and point of view. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely correct, and I think that any justice who's going to be picked from now on is going to be a predictable vote. The days of putting Cardozo on the court when Herbert Hoover was president only because he was the greatest judge in the United States, those days are over. The Supreme Court has become a predictable partisan institution. You want to know something? I argued 350 appeals in my life, something like that. I never wanted to argue in the Supreme Court. I did. Of course I argued in the Supreme Court. I never wanted to. Why? Because it didn't make a difference. I want to make a difference. If I argue in the Court of Appeals or the District Court, I can actually influence the outcome of the case. But when I argue in the Supreme Court, I've already counted noses. I know who's voting for me. I know who's voting against me. Occasionally, very rarely, in an unimportant case, you can persuade somebody to change their point of view. But if you're arguing abortion, you're arguing gay rights, you're not going to change anybody's point of view. They come onto the court with a point of view. You can predict that three of them on the left will always vote in that regard, and three or four on the right will always vote that way. And really, you're arguing mostly to Chief Justice Roberts and sometimes to Kavanaugh, but rarely to anybody else. So
that's scary.
That the Supreme Court has become predictable. Yeah.
Professor, that is scary because I've said that a lot of our federal agencies and have become politicized. And
without a doubt.
If our Supreme Court becomes politicized, then my God, what do we have our in for?
It's already politicized.
Well, but it's become more – see, it's always been political, but it's never been as partisan as this.
Well, that's what
and
I mean
I
by politicized.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, where it started. Did it start with the rejection of Bork or did it start with Bush versus Gore, where you have five Republicans voting for to stop the count and four Democrats voting to continue the count? Wherever it started in the last several years and blames on both sides – when the Republicans refused to give Merrick Garland a hearing because it was 8 months before the election and then immediately rushed through Barrett, even though it was only 1 month before the election, it became clear that these are political footballs that are being thrown around, and hypocrisy is the name of the game. And, you know, somebody once said that hypocrisy is the homage that vice pays to virtue. Not anymore. Today, you don't even have to pay homage. You just say, we have the votes, so we're going to not let so-and-so go through, and we have the votes, and we're going to let so-and-so go through. Consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds is the mantra in Washington now, and so people don't have to be consistent. But putting that aside, she seems like very highly qualified. Not only did she clerk for Steve Breyer, but she also worked for a great law firm in Washington called Miller, LaRocca, and Lewin, Nathan Lewin's law
firm. Matt Lewin, right.
Great law firm that also Barrett worked for, interestingly enough, and David Cohn, who's now deputy director of the CIA, worked for them. So they're a great, great law firm. And, you know, she's had just a stellar career. The public defender in Washington, D.C. is the best public defender office in the country. And it's run by terrific people. And she'll get a little flack for that when she's before the committee because, you know, she probably did bring about the acquittal of some guilty people. That's our job. And people don't like that. Imagine a country in which that didn't happen, in which you didn't get vigorous defense attorney. So, I think she's going to make it. It's going to be a close vote because it's going to be partisan. But I think that the two women Republicans who voted for her when she was up last time will continue to vote for her. So I think it'll be probably 52 to 48.
Alan, do you really think it's going to go that far? I think a really terrific move for the Senate Republicans right now is to just let it go.
Of course, that would be terrific. I agree with you. By the way, the interesting hypothetical, but it's only a hypothetical, is what if it were a 50-50 vote? Could the vice president break that vote? Alexander Hamilton said no. Alexander Hamilton said the vice president only gets to cast the deciding vote on legislation. Mm-hmm. Because if you let the vice president cast the deciding vote on nominations, then the executive has too much power. The executive nominates.
That's fascinating.
One thing we know is that in advise and consent, they said no.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. All right.
Well, we got a hard break. Alan Dershowitz, have a great weekend.
My pleasure.
And we'll talk again next week. And let's go to a hard break. And when we come back, we have Dr. Peter Michalow.
You're commuting home with Cats at Night. Now, here's John Katsimatidis on 77 WABC. Breaking news, WABC.
The Ukrainian President Zelensky, he is saying that Russian forces will storm tonight, and it's expected that Kiev could fall within the next 24 hours.
Wow. All right, let's come back to New York. I understand we got Dr. Peter Michalos on, and he always has some great medical or scientific advice. Dr. Michalos, what's up today?
Well, what's interesting today is that the CDC today said they're going to drop indoor mask mandates, but with a little caveat, for about 70% of the country, meaning that in low or medium risk areas, and that starting next week, they're going to release county by county risk levels weekly. So basically, you're going to have to wear a mask based on the proportion of beds occupied by COVID-19 patients in your local hospital and not the infection rate as they were doing it before. So they don't want to overwhelm or overrun the system, so they'll be announcing it. Also in the New York area, they dropped the outdoor school mask mandate, and it looks like Eric Adams just announced that possibly we might follow New Jersey and Connecticut. New Jersey on March 7th will drop the school masks for children, and February 28th, Connecticut is going to drop the school indoor mask mandate. So it shows that we are moving in a better direction. The cases are down in the United States as far as hospitalizations and the infection rate. The rest of the world still has quite a few cases. And the other great news is that hospitals started receiving yesterday the latest antibody that works against the Omicron and the new variant called Bebtelovimab by Eli Lilly. And that 600,000 doses were delivered when it got approved February 14th. It hit the hospitals yesterday. I know one patient who got it yesterday, and they started feeling better in 12 hours. So now we do have options. The thing that we've been slow on is getting the antiviral pills into the pharmacies.
Doctor, you get that intravenously?
Yeah, intravenously, and the same thing with the GlaxoSmithKline, one that continues to work, but it's in very short supply. The first 700,000 dose of that already got used up.
So in other words,
we're fortunate.
If you're very sick, you don't have to die.
No, it means that if you have any type of the risk factors and you catch COVID, don't waste time and just tell your doctor or your local ER, I'd like to take the monoclonal antibodies. If you're over 65, if you're overweight, you have diabetes, hypertension, autoimmune disease, you can avoid death. Thousands of people have been saved by these things already, and we're very fortunate that we have them.
We've got 30 seconds, doctor. What else would you like to tell people?
I would just like to tell people that continue to be realistic and be safe. Masks, again, are really just to protect the spread. So if you have symptoms, please wear a mask so you don't spread it, because that's what it's really for. And continue to eat healthy and go for your annual physicals and keep getting all your tests, your blood pressure, your colonoscopies, mammograms, all these things we haven't gotten, and stay healthy.
This weekend, you're going to be talking about blood pressures and how important it is. And stay tuned for Dr. Michalos for this weekend on talking about blood pressures. Thank you, Dr. Peter Michalos. Thank you, Judge Richard Weinberg, Governor Patterson, Congressman King. Thank you. And my sidekick, Lydia Serrani. I hope you enjoyed a weekend with your daughter. And all New Yorkers, God bless New York and God bless America.